Wet, muddy, and quite exhausted, she returned, and from that day the change which brought her where she now was began to operate in her soul. Beginning from that dreadful night, she ceased believing in God and in goodness. She had herself believed in God, and believed that other people also believed in him, but after that night she became convinced that no one believed, and that all that was said about God and his laws was deception and untruth. He whom she loved, and who had loved her, yes, she knew that, had thrown her away, had abused her love, yet he was the best of all the people she knew. All the rest were still worse. All that afterwards happened to her strengthened her in this belief at every step. His aunts, the pious old ladies, turned her out when she could no longer serve them as she used to. And of all those she met, the women used her as a means of getting money. The men, from the old police officer down to the warders of the prison, looked at her as on an object for pleasure, and no one in the world cared for aught but pleasure. In this belief, the old author with whom she had come together in the second year of her life of independence had strengthened her. He had told her outright that it was this that constituted the happiness of life, and he called it poetical and aesthetic. Everybody lived for himself only, for his pleasure, and all the talk concerning God and righteousness was deception. And if sometimes doubts arose in her mind, and she wondered why everything was so ill-arranged in the world that all hurt each other and made each other suffer, she thought it best not to dwell on it. And if she felt melancholy, she could smoke, or, better still, drink, and it would pass. Chapter 38. Sunday in Prison. Preparing for Mass. On Sunday morning at 5 o'clock, when a whistle sounded in the corridor of the women's ward of the prison, Korablyova, who was already awake, called Maslova.
"Oh, dear! Life again!"
thought Maslova with horror, involuntarily breathing in the air that had become terribly noisome towards the morning. She wished to fall asleep again, to enter into the region of oblivion, but the habit of fear overcame sleepiness, and she sat up and looked round, drawing her feet under her. The women had all got up, only the elder children were still asleep. The spirit trader was carefully drawing a cloak from under the children so as not to wake them. The watchman's wife was hanging up the rags to dry that served the baby as swaddling clothes, while the baby was screaming desperately in Theodosia's arms, who was trying to quiet it. The consumptive woman was coughing, with her hands pressed to her chest, while the blood rushed to her face, and she sighed loudly, almost screaming, in the intervals of coughing. The fat, red-haired woman was lying on her back, with knees drawn up, and loudly relating a dream. The old woman accused of incendiarism was standing in front of the image, crossing herself and bowing, and repeating the same words over and over again. The deacon's daughter sat on the bedstead, looking before her with a dull, sleepy face. Koroshavka was twisting her black, oily, coarse hair round her fingers. The sound of slip-shod feet was heard in the passage, and the door opened to let in two convicts, dressed in jackets and grey trousers that did not reach to their ankles. With serious, cross faces they lifted the stinking tub and carried it out of the cell. The women went out to the taps in the corridor to wash. There the red-haired woman again began a quarrel with a woman from another cell.
"Is it the solitary cell you want?"
shouted an old jailer, slapping the red-haired woman on her bare, fat back so that it sounded through the corridor.
"You be quiet!"
"Looks, the old one's playful," said the woman, taking his action for a caress.
"Now then, be quick, get ready for the mass!"
Maslova had hardly time to do her hair and dress when the inspector came with his assistants.
"Come out for inspection!" cried a jailer.
Some more prisoners came out of other cells and stood in two rows along the corridor. Each woman had to place her hand on the shoulder of the woman in front of her. They were all counted. After the inspection, the woman warder led the prisoners to church. Maslova and Theodosia were in the middle of a column of over 100 women who had come out of different cells. All were dressed in white skirts, white jackets, and wore white kerchiefs on their heads, except a few who had their own coloured clothes on. These were wives who, with their children, were following their convict husbands to Siberia. The whole flight of stairs was filled by the procession. The patter of softly shod feet mingled with the voices, and now and then a laugh.
When turning on the landing, Maslova saw her enemy, Borchkova, in front and pointed out her angry face to Theodosia. At the bottom of the stairs the women stopped talking. Bowing and crossing themselves, they entered the empty church, which glistened with gilding. Crowding and pushing one another, they took their places on the right. After the women came the men condemned to banishment, those serving their term in the prison, and those exiled by their communes, and, coughing loudly, they took their stand, crowding the left side and the middle of the church. On one side of the gallery above stood the men sentenced to penal servitude in Siberia, who had been let into the church before the others. Each of them had half his head shaved, and their presence was indicated by the clanking of the chains on their feet. On the other side of the gallery stood those in preliminary confinement, without chains, their heads not shaved. The prison church had been rebuilt and ornamented by a rich merchant, who spent several tens of thousands of roubles on it, and it glittered with gay colours and gold. For a time there was silence in the church, and only coughing, blowing of noses, the crying of babies, and now and then the rattling of chains was heard. But at last the convicts that stood in the middle moved, pressed against each other, leaving a passage in the centre of the church down which the prison inspector passed, to take his place in front of everyone in the nave. Chapter 39. The Prison Church. Blind Leaders of the Blind. The service began. It consisted of the following: the priest, having dressed in a strange and very inconvenient garb made of gold cloth, cut and arranged little bits of bread on a saucer, and then put them into a cup with wine, repeating at the same time different names and prayers. Meanwhile the deacon first read Slavonic prayers, difficult to understand in themselves, and rendered still more incomprehensible by being read very fast, and then sang them turn and turn about with the convicts. The contents of the prayers were chiefly the desire for the welfare of the emperor and his family. These petitions were repeated many times, separately, and together with other prayers, the people kneeling. Besides this, several verses from the Acts of the Apostles were read by the deacon in a peculiarly strained voice, which made it impossible to understand what he read. And then the priest read very distinctly a part of the Gospel according to St. Mark, in which it said that Christ, having risen from the dead before flying up to heaven to sit down at his Father's right hand, first showed himself to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had driven seven devils, and then to 11 of his disciples, and ordered them to preach the Gospel to the whole creation. And the priest added that if anyone did not believe this, he would perish, but he that believed it and was baptized should be saved, and should besides drive out devils and cure people by laying his hands on them, should talk in strange tongues, should take up serpents, and if he drank poison should not die but remain well. The essence of the service consisted in the supposition that the bits cut up by the priest and put by him into the wine, when manipulated and prayed over in a certain way, turned into the flesh and blood of God. These manipulations consisted in the priest's regularly lifting and holding up his arms, though hampered by the gold cloth sack he had on, then sinking on to his knees and kissing the table and all that was on it, but chiefly in his taking a cloth by two of its corners and waving it regularly and softly over the silver saucer and golden cup. It was supposed that at this point the bread and the wine turned into flesh and blood, therefore this part of the service was performed with the greatest solemnity.
"Now to the blessed, most pure, and most holy Mother of God!" the priest cried from the golden partition which divided part of the church from the rest, and the choir began solemnly to sing that it was very right to glorify the Virgin Mary, who had borne Christ without losing her virginity, and was therefore worthy of greater honour than some kind of cherubim, and greater glory than some kind of seraphim. After this the transformation was considered accomplished, and the priest, having taken the napkin off the saucer, cut the middle bit of bread in four, and put it into the wine, and then into his mouth. He was supposed to have eaten a bit of God's flesh, and swallowed a little of his blood. Then the priest drew a curtain, opened the middle door in the partition, and, taking the gold cup in his hands, came out of the door, inviting those who wished to do so also to come and eat some of God's flesh and blood that was contained in the cup. A few children appeared to wish to do so.
After having asked the children their names, the priest carefully took out of the cup, with a spoon, and shoved a bit of bread soaked in wine deep into the mouth of each child in turn, and the deacon, while wiping the children's mouths, sang, in a merry voice, that the children were eating the flesh and drinking the blood of God. After this, the priest carried the cup back behind the partition, and there drank all the remaining blood and ate up all the bits of flesh, and after having carefully sucked his moustaches and wiped his mouth, he stepped briskly from behind the partition, the soles of his calfskin boots creaking. The principal part of this Christian service was now finished, but the priest, wishing to comfort the unfortunate prisoners, added to the ordinary service another. This consisted of his going up to the gilt, hammered-out image, with black face and hands, supposed to represent the very God he had been eating, illuminated by a dozen wax candles, and proceeding in a strange, discordant voice to hum or sing the following words: "Jesu, sweetest, glorified of the apostles, Jesu, lauded by the martyrs, almighty monarch, save me, Jesu, my Saviour. Jesu, most beautiful, have mercy on him who cries to thee, Saviour Jesu. Born of prayer, Jesu, all thy saints, all thy prophets, save and find them worthy of the joys of heaven. Jesu, lover of men." Then he stopped, drew breath, crossed himself, bowed to the ground, and everyone did the same, the inspector, the warders, the prisoners, and from above the clinking of the chains sounded more unintermittently. Then he continued, "Of angels, the Creator and Lord of powers, Jesu most wonderful, the angels' amazement, Jesu most powerful, of our forefathers the Redeemer, Jesu sweetest, of patriarchs the praise, Jesu most glorious, of kings the strength, Jesu most good, of prophets the fulfilment, Jesu most amazing, of martyrs the strength, Jesu most humble, of monks the joy, Jesu most merciful, of priests the sweetness, Jesu most charitable, of the fasting the continence, Jesu most sweet, of the just the joy, Jesu most pure, of the celibates the chastity, Jesu before all ages of sinners the salvation, Jesu, Son of God, have mercy on me." Every time he repeated the word Jesu, his voice became more and more wheezy. At last he came to a stop, and holding up his silk-lined cassock and kneeling down on one knee, he stooped down to the ground, and the choir began to sing, repeating the words, "Jesu, Son of God, have mercy on me," and the convicts fell down and rose again, shaking back the hair that was left on their heads, and rattling with the chains that were bruising their thin ankles. This continued for a long time. First came the glorification, which ended with the words, "Have mercy on me," then more glorifications, ending with, "Alleluia," and the convicts made the sign of the cross, and bowed, first at each sentence, then after every two, and then after three, and all were very glad when the glorification ended, and the priest shut the book with a sigh of relief and retired behind the partition. One last act remained. The priest took a large gilt cross with enamel medallions at the ends from a table, and came out into the centre of the church with it. First the inspector came up and kissed the cross, then the jailers, then the convicts, pushing and abusing each other in whispers. The priest, talking to the inspector, pushed the cross and his hand now against the mouths and now against the noses of the convicts, who were trying to kiss both the cross and the hand of the priest. And thus ended the Christian service, intended for the comfort and the teaching of these strayed brothers. Chapter 40. The Husks of Religion. And none of those present, from the inspector down to Maslova, seemed conscious of the fact that this Jesus, whose name the priest repeated such a great number of times, and whom he praised with all these curious expressions, had forbidden the very things that were being done there. That he had prohibited not only this meaningless, much speaking, and the blasphemous incantation over the bread and wine, but had also, in the clearest words, forbidden men to call other men their master, and to pray in temples, and had ordered that everyone should pray in solitude, had forbidden to erect temples, saying that he had come to destroy them, and that one should worship not in a temple, but in spirit and in truth, and, above all, that he had forbidden not only to judge, to imprison, to torment, to execute men, as was being done here, but had prohibited any kind of violence, saying that he had come to give freedom to the captives. No one present seemed conscious
that all that was going on here was the greatest blasphemy and a supreme mockery of that same Christ in whose name it was being done. And no one seemed to realize that the gilt cross with the enamel medallions at the ends, which the priest held out to the people to be kissed, was nothing but the emblem of that gallows on which Christ had been executed for denouncing just what was going on here, that these priests, who imagined they were eating and drinking the body and blood of Christ in the form of bread and wine, did in reality eat and drink his flesh and his blood, but not as wine and bits of bread, but by ensnaring these little ones with whom he identified himself, by depriving them of the greatest blessings and submitting them to most cruel torments, and by hiding from men the tidings of great joy which he had brought. That thought did not enter into the mind of any one present. The priest did his part with a quiet conscience, because he was brought up from childhood to consider that the only true faith was the faith which had been held by all the holy men of olden times, and was still held by the church, and demanded by the state authorities. He did not believe that the bread turned into flesh, that it was useful for the soul to repeat so many words, or that he had actually swallowed a bit of God. No one could believe this, but he believed that one ought to hold this faith. What strengthened him most in this faith was the fact that, for fulfilling the demands of this faith, he had for the last 15 years been able to draw an income which enabled him to keep his family, send his son to a gymnasium, and his daughter to a school for the daughters of the clergy. The deacon believed in the same manner, and even more firmly than the priest, for he had forgotten the substance of the dogmas of this faith, and knew only that the prayers for the dead, the masses, with and without the acathistus, all had a definite price, which real Christians readily paid, and therefore he called out his have mercy very willingly, and read and said what was appointed, with the same quiet certainty of its being necessary to do so with which other men sell faggots, flour, or potatoes. The prison inspector and the warders, though they had never understood or gone into the meaning of these dogmas, and of all that went on in church, believed that they must believe because the higher authorities and the Tsar himself believed in it. Besides, though faintly, and themselves unable to explain why, they felt that this faith defended their cruel occupations. If this faith did not exist, it would have been more difficult, perhaps impossible, for them to use all their powers to torment people, as they were now doing, with a quiet conscience. The inspector was such a kind-hearted man that he could not have lived as he was now living, unsupported by his faith. Therefore he stood motionless, bowed, and crossed himself zealously, tried to feel touched when the song about the cherubims was being sung, and when the children received communion he lifted one of them and held him up to the priest with his own hands. The great majority of the prisoners believed that there lay a mystic power in these gilt images, these vestments, candles, cups, crosses, and this repetition of incomprehensible words, Jesu sweetest, and have mercy, a power through which might be obtained much convenience in this and in the future life. Only a few clearly saw the deception that was practiced on the people who adhered to this faith, and laughed at it in their hearts. But the majority, having made several attempts to get the conveniences they desired by means of prayers, masses, and candles, and not having got them, their prayers remaining unanswered, were each of them convinced that their want of success was accidental, and that this organization, approved by the educated and by archbishops, is very important and necessary, if not for this, at any rate for the next life. Maslova also believed in this way. She felt, like the rest, a mixed sensation of piety and dullness. She stood at first in a crowd behind a railing, so that she could see no one but her companions. But when those to receive communion moved on, she and Theodosia stepped to the front, and they saw the inspector, and behind him, standing among the warders, a little peasant with a very light beard and fair hair. This was Theodosia's husband, and he was gazing with fixed eyes at his wife. During the acathistus, Maslova occupied herself in scrutinizing him, and talking to Theodosia in whispers, and bowed, and made the sign of the cross only when everyone else did. Chapter 41. Visiting Day. The Men's Ward. Nekhludov left home early. A peasant from the country was still driving along the side street and calling out in a voice peculiar to his trade, "Milk! Milk! Milk!" The first warm spring rain had fallen the day before, and now wherever the ground was not paved, the grass shone green.
The birch trees in the gardens looked as if they were strewn with green fluff. The wild cherry and the poplars unrolled their long, balmy buds, and in shops and dwelling houses the double window frames were being removed and the windows cleaned. In the Tolkuchi market, which Nekhludov had to pass on his way, a dense crowd was surging along the row of booths, and tattered men walked about selling top boots, which they carried under their arms, and renovated trousers and waistcoats, which hung over their shoulders. Men in clean coats and shining boots, liberated from the factories, it being Sunday, and women with bright silk kerchiefs on their heads and cloth jackets trimmed with jet, were already thronging at the door of the traktir. Policemen with yellow cords to their uniforms and carrying pistols were on duty, looking out for some disorder which might distract the ennui that oppressed them. On the paths of the boulevards and on the newly revived grass children and dogs ran about playing, and the nurses sat merrily chattering on the benches. Along the streets, still fresh and damp on the shady side but dry in the middle, heavy carts rumbled unceasingly, cabs rattled and tramcars passed ringing by. The air vibrated with the pealing and clanging of church bells that were calling the people to attend to a service like that which was now being conducted in the prison, and the people, dressed in their Sunday best, were passing on their way to their different parish churches. The izvochik did not drive Nekhludov up to the prison itself, but to the last turning that led to the prison. Several persons, men and women, most of them carrying small bundles, stood at this turning about 100 steps from the prison. To the right there were several low wooden buildings, to the left a two-storied house with a signboard. The huge brick building, the prison proper, was just in front, and the visitors were not allowed to come up to it. A sentinel was pacing up and down in front of it, and shouted at anyone who tried to pass him. At the gate of the wooden buildings to the right, opposite the sentinel, sat a warder on a bench, dressed in uniform, with gold cords, a notebook in his hands. The visitors came up to him and named the persons they wanted to see, and he put the names down. Nekhludov also went up, and named Katerina Maslova. The warder wrote down the name.
"Why don't they admit us yet?" asked Nekhludov. "The service is going on. When the mess is over, you'll be admitted."
Nekhludov stepped aside from the waiting crowd. A man in tattered clothes, crumpled hat, with bare feet and red stripes all over his face, detached himself from the crowd and turned towards the prison.
"Now then, where are you going?" shouted the sentinel with the gun. "And you hold your row," answered the tramp, not in the least abashed by the sentinel's words, and turned back. "Well, if you'll not let me in, I'll wait. But no, must needs shout as if he were a general."
The crowd laughed approvingly. The visitors were, for the greater part, badly dressed people. Some were ragged, but there were also some respectable-looking men and women. Next to Nekhludov stood a clean-shaven, stout and red-cheeked man holding a bundle, apparently containing undergarments. This was the doorkeeper of a bank. He had come to see his brother, who was arrested for forgery. The good-natured fellow told Nekhludov the whole story of his life, and was going to question him in turn when their attention was aroused by a student and a veiled lady who drove up in a trap, with rubber tyres, drawn by a large thoroughbred horse. The student was holding a large bundle. He came up to Nekhludov and asked if and how he could give the rolls he had brought in alms to the prisoners. His fiancée wished it. This lady was his fiancée, and her parents had advised them to take some rolls to the prisoners. "I myself am here for the first time," said Nekhludov, "and don't know, but I think you had better ask this man." And he pointed to the warder with the gold cords and the book sitting on the right. As they were speaking, the large iron door with a window in it opened, and an officer in uniform, followed by another warder, stepped out. The warder with a notebook proclaimed that the admittance of visitors would now commence. The sentinel stepped aside, and all the visitors rushed to the door as if afraid of being too late. Some even ran. At the door there stood a warder who counted the visitors as they came in, saying aloud, 16, 17, and so on. Another warder stood inside the building and also counted the visitors as they entered a second door, touching each one with his hand, so that when they went away again, not one visitor should be able to remain inside the prison, and not one prisoner might get out. The warder, without looking at whom he was touching, slapped Nekhludov on the back, and Nekhludov felt hurt by the touch of the warder's hand. But, remembering what he had come about, he felt ashamed of feeling dissatisfied and taking offence. The first apartment, behind the entrance doors, was a large vaulted room with iron bars to the small windows. In this room, which was called the meeting room, Nekhludov was startled by the sight of a large picture of the crucifixion. "What's that for?" he thought, his mind involuntarily connecting the subject of the picture with liberation and not with imprisonment. He went on, slowly letting the hurrying visitors pass before, and experiencing a mingled feeling of horror at the evildoers locked up in this building, compassion for those who, like Katyusha and the boy they tried the day before, must be here though guiltless, and shyness and tender emotion at the thought of the interview before him. The warder at the other end of the meeting room said something as they passed, but Nekhludov, absorbed by his own thoughts, paid no attention to him, and continued to follow the majority of the visitors, and so got into the men's part of the prison, instead of the women's. Letting the hurrying visitors pass before him, he was the last to get into the interviewing room. As soon as Nekhludov opened the door of this room, he was struck by the deafening roar of 100 voices shouting at once, the reason of which he did not at once understand. But when he came nearer to the people, he saw that they were all pressing against a net that divided the room in two like flies settling on sugar, and he understood what it meant. The two halves of the room, the windows of which were opposite the door he had come in by, were separated, not by one, but by two nets, reaching from the floor to the ceiling. The wire nets were stretched 7 feet apart, and soldiers were walking up and down the space between them. On the further side of the nets were the prisoners, on the nearer, the visitors. Between them was a double row of nets and a space of 7 feet wide, so that they could not hand anything to one another, and anyone whose sight was not very good could not even distinguish the face on the other side. It was also difficult to talk. One had to scream in order to be heard. On both sides were faces pressed close to the nets, faces of wives, husbands, fathers, mothers, children, trying to see each other's features and to say what was necessary in such a way as to be understood. But as each one tried to be heard by the one he was talking to, and his neighbour tried to do the same, they did their best to drown each other's voices, and that was the cause of the din and shouting which struck Nekhludov when he first came in. It was impossible to understand what was being said, and what were the relations between the different people. Next, Nekhludov, an old woman with a kerchief on her head, stood trembling, her chin pressed close to the net, and shouting something to a young fellow, half of whose head was shaved, who listened attentively with raised brows. By the side of the old woman was a young man in a peasant's coat, who listened, shaking his head, to a boy very like himself. Next stood a man in rags, who shouted, waving his arm and laughing. Next to him, a woman, with a good woollen shawl on her shoulders, sat on the floor holding a baby in her lap and crying bitterly. This was apparently the first time she saw the grey-headed man on the other side, in prison clothes, and with his head shaved. Beyond her was the doorkeeper, who had spoken to Nekhludov outside. He was shouting with all his might to a grey-haired convict on the other side. When Nekhludov found that he would have to speak in similar conditions, a feeling of indignation against those who were able to make and enforce these conditions arose in him. He was surprised that, placed in such a dreadful position, no one seemed offended at this outrage on human feelings. The soldiers, the inspector, the prisoners themselves acted as if acknowledging all this to be necessary. Nekhludov remained in this room for about 5 minutes, feeling strangely depressed, conscious of how powerless he was, and at variance with all the world. He was seized with a curious moral sensation like seasickness. Chapter 42. Visiting Day, the Women's Ward.
"Well, but I must do what I came here for," he said, trying to pick up courage. "What is to be done now?" He looked round for an official, and seeing a thin little man in the uniform of an officer going up and down behind the people, he approached him. "Can you tell me, sir," he said, with exceedingly strained politeness of manner, "where the women are kept, and where one is allowed to interview them?"
"Is it the women's ward you want to go to?" "Yes, I should like to see one of the women prisoners," Nekhludov said, with the same strained politeness.
"You should have said so when you were in the hall. Who is it, then, that you want to see?"
"I want to see a prisoner called Katerina Maslova."
"Is she a political one?"
"No, she is simply..."
"What? Is she sentenced?"
"Yes, the day before yesterday she was sentenced," meekly answered Nekhludov, fearing to spoil the inspector's good humour, which seemed to incline in his favour.
"If you want to go to the women's ward, please to step this way," said the officer,
having decided from Nekhludov's appearance that he was worthy of attention.
"Sidorov, conduct the gentleman to the women's ward,"
he said, turning to a moustached corporal with medals on his breast.
"Yes, sir."
At this moment, heart-rending sobs were heard coming from someone near the net. Everything here seemed strange to Nekhludov. But strangest of all was that he should have to thank and feel obligation towards the inspector and the chief warders, the very men who were performing the cruel deeds that were done in this house. The corporal showed Nekhludov through the corridor, out of the men's, into the women's interviewing room. This room, like that of the men, was divided by two wire nets, but it was much smaller, and there were fewer visitors and fewer prisoners, so that there was less shouting than in the men's room. Yet the same thing was going on here, only, between the nets, instead of soldiers, there was a woman warder, dressed in a blue-edged uniform jacket with gold cords on the sleeves and a blue belt. Here also, as in the men's room, the people were pressing close to the wire netting on both sides. On the nearer side, the townspeople in varied attire. On the further side, the prisoners, some in white prison clothes, others in their own coloured dresses. The whole length of the net was taken up by the people standing close to it. Some rose on tiptoe to be heard across the heads of others. Some sat, talking, on the floor. The most remarkable of the prisoners, both by her piercing screams and her appearance, was a thin, dishevelled gypsy. Her kerchief had slipped off her curly hair, and she stood near a post, in the middle of the prisoners' division, shouting something, accompanied by quick gestures, to a gypsy man in a blue coat girdled tightly below the waist. Next the gypsy man, a soldier, sat on the ground talking to a prisoner. Next the soldier, leaning close to the net, stood a young peasant with a fair beard and a flushed face, keeping back his tears with difficulty. A pretty, fair-haired prisoner with bright blue eyes was speaking to him. These two were Theodosia and her husband. Next to them was a tramp talking to a broad-faced woman, then two women, then a man, then again a woman, and in front of each a prisoner. Maslova was not among them. But someone stood by the window behind the prisoners, and Nekhludov knew it was she. His heart began to beat faster, and his breath stopped. The decisive moment was approaching. He went up to the part of the net where he could see the prisoner, and recognized her at once. She stood behind the blue-eyed Theodosia and smiled, listening to what Theodosia was saying. She did not wear the prison cloak now, but a white dress, tightly drawn in at the waist by a belt and very full in the bosom. From under her kerchief appeared the black ringlets of her fringe, just the same as in the court. "Now, in a moment it will be decided," he thought. "How shall I call her? Or will she come herself?" She was expecting Berta. That this man had come to see her never entered her head.
"Whom do you want?"
said the warder who was walking between the nets, coming up to Nekhludov.
"Katerina Maslova,"
Nekhludov uttered with difficulty.
"Katerina Maslova, someone to see you,"
cried the warder. Chapter 43. Nekhludov visits Maslova. Maslova looked round and, with head thrown back and expanded chest, came up to the net with that expression of readiness which he well knew, pushed in between two prisoners, and gazed at Nekhludov with a surprised and questioning look. But, concluding from his clothing he was a rich man, she smiled.
"Is it me you want?"
she asked, bringing her smiling face with the slightly squinting eyes nearer the net.
I wished to see..."
Nekhludov did not know how to address her.
"I wished to see you. I..."
He was not speaking louder than usual.
"No! Nonsense, I tell you!"
shouted the tramp who stood next to him.
"Have you taken it or not?
dying, I tell you. What more do you want?"
someone else was screaming at his other side. Maslova could not hear what Nekhludov was saying, but the expression of his face as he was speaking reminded her of him. She did not believe her own eyes. Still, the smile vanished from her face, and a deep line of suffering appeared on her brow.
"I cannot hear what you are saying,"
she called out, wrinkling her brow and frowning more and more.
"I have come," said Nekhludov.
"Yes, I'm doing my duty. I am confessing," thought Nekhludov. And at this thought the tears came in his eyes, and he felt a choking sensation in his throat, and holding on with both hands to the net, he made efforts to keep from bursting into tears.
"I say, why do you shove yourself in where you're not wanted?"
someone shouted at one side of him.
"God is my witness! I know nothing!"
screamed a prisoner from the other side. Noticing his excitement, Maslova recognized him.
"You're like... But no, I don't know you,"
she shouted without looking at him, and blushing while her face grew still more stern.
"I have come to ask you to forgive me,"
he said, in a loud but monotonous voice, like a lesson learnt by heart. Having said these words, he became confused, but immediately came the thought that, if he felt ashamed, it was all the better. He had to bear this shame, and he continued in a loud voice,
"Forgive me! I have wronged you terribly!"
She stood motionless and without taking her squinting eyes off him. He could not continue to speak, and stepping away from the net, he tried to suppress the sobs that were choking him. The inspector, the same officer who had directed Nekhludov to the women's ward, and whose interest he seemed to have aroused, came into the room and, seeing Nekhludov not at the net, asked him why he was not talking to her whom he wanted to see. Nekhludov blew his nose, gave himself a shake, and trying to appear calm, said,
"It's so inconvenient, through these nets. Nothing can be heard."
Again the inspector considered for a moment.
"Ah, well, she can be brought out here for a while. Mary Karlovna,"
turning to the warder,
"lead Maslova out."
A minute later Maslova came out of the side door. Stepping softly, she came up close to Nekhludov, stopped and looked up at him from under her brows. Her black hair was arranged in ringlets over her forehead, in the same way as it had been 2 days ago. Her face, though unhealthy and puffy, was attractive, and looked perfectly calm. Only the glittering black eyes glanced strangely from under the swollen lids.
"You may talk here,"
said the inspector, and shrugging his shoulders, he stepped aside with a look of surprise. Nekhludov moved towards a seat by the wall. Maslova cast a questioning look at the inspector, and then, shrugging her shoulders in surprise, followed Nekhludov to the bench, and having arranged her skirt, sat down beside him.
"I know it is hard for you to forgive me," he began, but stopped.
His tears were choking him.
"But though I can't undo the past, I shall now do what is in my power. Tell me,
how have you managed to find me?"
she said, without answering his question, neither looking away from him nor quite at him with her squinting eyes.
"Oh, God help me. Teach me what to do," Nekhludov thought, looking at her changed face.
"I was on the jury the day before yesterday," he said. "You did not recognize me?"
"No, I did not. There was not time for recognitions. I did not even look," she said.
"There was a child, was there not?" he asked.
"Thank God. He died at once,"
she answered abruptly and viciously.
"What do you mean? Why?"
"I was so ill myself I nearly died,"
she said, in the same quiet voice which Nekhludov had not expected and could not understand.
"How could my aunts have let you go?"
"Who keeps a servant that has a baby? They sent me off as soon as they noticed. But why speak of this? I remember nothing. That's all finished."
"No, it is not finished. I wish to redeem my sin."
"There's nothing to redeem. What's been has been and is past," she said.
And, what he never expected, she looked at him and smiled in an unpleasantly luring yet piteous manner. Maslova never expected to see him again, and certainly not here, and not now. Therefore, when she first recognized him, she could not keep back the memories which she never wished to revive. In the first moment she remembered dimly that new, wonderful world of feeling and of thought which had been opened to her by the charming young man who loved her and whom she loved, and then his incomprehensible cruelty and the whole string of humiliations and suffering which flowed from and followed that magic joy. This gave her pain, and, unable to understand it, she did what she was always in the habit of doing. She got rid of these memories by enveloping them in the mist of a depraved life. In the first moment she associated the man now sitting beside her with the lad she had loved, but feeling that this gave her pain, she dissociated them again. Now this well-dressed, carefully got-up gentleman with perfumed beard was no longer the Nekhludov whom she had loved, but only one of the people who made use of creatures like herself when they needed them, and whom creatures like herself had to make use of in their turn as profitably as they could, and that is why she looked at him with a luring smile and considered silently how she could best make use of him.
"That's all at an end," she said. "Now I'm condemned to Siberia."
And her lip trembled as she was saying this dreadful word. "I knew. I was certain you were not guilty," said Nekhludov.
"Guilty? Of course not. As if I could be a thief or a robber."
She stopped, considering in what way she could best get something out of him.
"They say here that all depends on the advocate," she began. "A petition should be handed in, only they say it's expensive."
"Yes, most certainly," said Nekhludov. "I have already spoken to an advocate."
"No money ought to be spared. It should be a good one," she said.
"I shall do all that is possible." They were silent, and then she smiled again in the same way.
"And I should like to ask you a little money, if you can. Not much, 10 roubles, I do not want more," she said suddenly.
"Yes, yes," Nekhludov said with a sense of confusion, and felt for his purse. She looked rapidly at the inspector who was walking up and down the room.
"Don't give it in front of him, he'd take it away."
Nekhludov took out his purse as soon as the inspector had turned his back, but had no time to hand her the note before the inspector faced them again, so he crushed it up in his hand. "This woman is dead," Nekhludov thought, looking at this once sweet and now defiled, puffy face, lit up by an evil glitter in the black, squinting eyes which were now glancing at the hand in which he held the note, then following the inspector's movements, and for a moment he hesitated. The tempter that had been speaking to him in the night again raised its voice, trying to lead him out of the realm of his inner into the realm of his outer life, away from the question of what he should do to the question of what the consequences would be and what would be practical. "You can do nothing with this woman," said the voice. "You will only tie a stone round your neck which will help to drown you and hinder you from being useful to others."
"Is it not better to give her all the money that is here, say good-bye and finish with her forever?"
whispered the voice. But here he felt that now, at this very moment, something most important was taking place in his soul, that his inner life was, as it were, wavering in the balance, so that the slightest effort would make it sink to this side or the other. And he made this effort by calling to his assistance that God whom he had felt in his soul the day before, and that God instantly responded. He resolved to tell her everything now, at once.
"Katyusha, I have come to ask you to forgive me, and you have given me no answer.
Have you forgiven me?
Will you ever forgive me?" he asked.
She did not listen to him, but looked at his hand and at the inspector, and when the latter turned she hastily stretched out her hand, grasped the note, and hid it under her belt.
"That's odd, what you are saying there," she said, with a smile of contempt, as it seemed to him.
Nekhludov felt that there was in her soul one who was his enemy, and who was protecting her, such as she was now, and preventing him from getting at her heart. But, strange to say, this did not repel him, but drew him nearer to her by some fresh, peculiar power. He knew that he must waken her soul, that this was terribly difficult, but the very difficulty attracted him. He now felt towards her as he had never felt towards her or anyone else before. There was nothing personal in this feeling. He wanted nothing from her for himself, but only wished that she might not remain as she now was,
that she might awaken and become again what she had been.
"Katyusha, why do you speak like that?
I know you. I remember you, and the old days in Papovo."
"What's the use of recalling what's past?" she remarked dryly.
"I am recalling it in order to put it right, to atone for my sin, Katyusha."
And he was going to say that he would marry her, but, meeting her eyes, he read in them something so dreadful, so coarse, so repellent, that he could not go on.
At this moment the visitors began to go. The inspector came up to Nekhludov and said that the time was up.
"Goodbye. I have still much to say to you, but you see it is impossible to do so now," said Nekhludov, and held out his hand.
"I shall come again."
"I think you have said all."
She took his hand, but did not press it.
"No, I shall try to see you again, somewhere where we can talk, and then I shall tell you what I have to say, something very important."
"Well, then, come, why not?" she answered, and smiled with that habitual, inviting, and promising smile which she gave to the men whom she wished to please.
"You are more than a sister to me," said Nekhludov.
"That's odd," she said again, and went behind the grating.
Chapter 44. Maslova's View of Life. Before the first interview, Nekhludov thought that when she saw him and knew of his intention to serve her, Katyusha would be pleased and touched, and would be Katyusha again. But to his horror he found that Katyusha existed no more, and there was Maslova in her place. This astonished and horrified him. What astonished him most was that Katyusha was not ashamed of her position, not the position of a prisoner, she was ashamed of that, but her position as a prostitute. She seemed satisfied, even proud of it. And yet, how could it be otherwise? Everybody, in order to be able to act, has to consider his occupation important and good. Therefore, in whatever position a person is, he is certain to form such a view of the life of men in general, which will make his occupation seem important and good. It is usually imagined that a thief, a murderer, a spy, a prostitute, acknowledging his or her profession as evil, is ashamed of it. But the contrary is true. People whom fate and their sin mistakes have placed in a certain position, however false that position may be, form a view of life in general which makes their position seem good and admissible. In order to keep up their view of life, these people instinctively keep to the circle of those people who share their views of life and their own place in it. This surprises us, where the persons concerned are thieves, bragging about their dexterity, prostitutes vaunting their depravity, or murderers boasting of their cruelty. This surprises us only because the circle, the atmosphere in which these people live, is limited, and we are outside it. But can we not observe the same phenomenon when the rich boast of their wealth, i.e. robbery? The commanders in the army pride themselves on victories, i.e. murder, and those in high places vaunt their power, i.e. violence. We do not see the perversion in the views of life held by these people, only because the circle formed by them is more extensive, and we ourselves are moving inside of it. And in this manner Maslova had formed her views of life and of her own position. She was a prostitute condemned to Siberia, and yet she had a conception of life which made it possible for her to be satisfied with herself, and even to pride herself on her position before others. According to this conception, the highest good for all men without exception, old, young, schoolboys, generals, educated and uneducated, was connected with the relation of the sexes. Therefore all men, even when they pretended to be occupied with other things, in reality took this view. She was an attractive woman, and therefore she was an important and necessary person. The whole of her former and present life was a confirmation of the correctness of this conception. With such a view of life she was by no means the lowest, but a very important person. And Maslova prized this view of life more than anything. She could not but prize it, for if she lost the importance that such a view of life gave her among men, she would lose the meaning of her life.
and in order not to lose the meaning of her life, she instinctively clung to the set that looked at life in the same way as she did. Feeling that Nekhludov wanted to lead her out into another world, she resisted him, foreseeing that she would have to lose her place in life with the self-possession and self-respect it gave her. For this reason she drove from her the recollections of her early youth and her first relations with Nekhludov. These recollections did not correspond with her present conception of the world, and were therefore quite rubbed out of her mind, or rather lay somewhere buried and untouched, closed up and plastered over so that they should not escape, as when bees, in order to protect the result of their labour, will sometimes plaster a nest of worms. Therefore, the present Nekhludov was not the man she had once loved with a pure love, but only a rich gentleman, whom she could and must make use of, and with whom she could only have the same relations as with men in general. No, I could not tell her the chief thing, thought Nekhludov, moving towards the front doors with the rest of the people. I did not tell her that I would marry her. I did not tell her so, but I will, he thought. The two warders at the door let out the visitors, counting them again, and touching each one with their hands, so that no extra person should go out and none remain within. The slap on his shoulder did not offend Nekhludov this time. He did not even notice it. Chapter 45. Fanarin, the Advocate, the Petition. Nekhludov meant to rearrange the whole of his external life, to let his large house and move to an hotel. But Agrafena Petrovna pointed out that it was useless to change anything before the winter. No one would rent a townhouse for the summer. Anyhow, he would have to live and keep his things somewhere, and so all his efforts to change his manner of life, he meant to live more simply as the students live, led to nothing. Not only did everything remain as it was, but the house was suddenly filled with new activity. All that was made of wool or fur was taken out to be aired and beaten. The gatekeeper, the boy, the cook, and Corny himself took part in this activity. All sorts of strange furs, which no one ever used, and various uniforms were taken out and hung on a line. Then the carpets and furniture were brought out, and the gatekeeper and the boy rolled their sleeves up their muscular arms and stood beating these things, keeping strict time while the rooms were filled with a smell of naphthalene. When Nekhludov crossed the yard, or looked out of the window and saw all this going on, he was surprised at the great number of things that were all quite useless. Their only use, Nekhludov thought, was the providing of exercise for Agrafena Petrovna, Corny, the gatekeeper, the boy, and the cook. "But it's not worthwhile altering my manner of life now," he thought, "while Maslova's case is not decided. Besides, it is too difficult. It will alter of itself when she will be set free or exiled, and I follow her." On the appointed day, Nekhludov drove up to the advocate Fanarin's own splendid house, which was decorated with huge palms and other plants, and wonderful curtains, in fact, with all the expensive luxury witnessing to the possession of much idle money, i.e. money acquired without labour, which only those possess who grow rich suddenly. In the waiting room, just as in a doctor's waiting room, he found many dejected-looking people sitting round several tables, on which lay illustrated papers meant to amuse them, awaiting their turns to be admitted to the advocate. The advocate's assistant sat in the room at a high desk, and having recognised Nekhludov, he came up to him and said he would go and announce him at once. But the assistant had not reached the door before it opened, and the sounds of loud, animated voices were heard. The voice of a middle-aged, sturdy merchant with a red face and thick moustaches, and the voice of Fanarin himself. Fanarin was also a middle-aged man of medium height, with a worn look on his face. Both faces bore the expression which you see on the faces of those who have just concluded a profitable but not quite honest transaction. "Your own fault, you know, my dear sir," Fanarin said, smiling. "We'd all be in heaven, were it not for our sins." "Oh, yes, yes, we all know that." And both laughed unnaturally. "Oh, Prince Nekhludov, pleased to step in," said Fanarin. Seeing him, and nodding once more to the merchant, he led Nekhludov into his business cabinet, furnished in a severely correct style.
"'Won't you smoke?' said the advocate, sitting down opposite Nekhludov and trying to conceal a smile, apparently still excited by the success of the accomplished transaction.
"'Thanks. I have come about Maslova's case.'
"'Yes, yes, directly. But, oh, what rogues these fat money-bags are,' he said. "'You saw this here fellow. Why, he has about 12 million rubles, and he cannot speak correctly. And if he can get a 25-ruble note out of you, he'll have it, if he's to wrench it out with his teeth.'
"'He says, Evan and Hauer, and you say, this here fellow,' Nekhludov thought, with an insurmountable feeling of aversion towards this man, who wished to show by his free-and-easy manner that he and Nekhludov belonged to one and the same camp, while his other clients belonged to another.
"'He has worried me to death, a fearful scoundrel. I felt I must relieve my feelings,' said the advocate, as if to excuse his speaking about things that had no reference to business. "'Well, how about your case? I have read it attentively, but do not approve of it.' "'I mean that greenhorn of an advocate has left no valid reason for an appeal.'
"'Well, then, what have you decided?'
"'One moment. Tell him,' he said to his assistant, who had just come in, "'that I keep to what I have said. If he can, it's all right. If not, no matter.'
"'But he won't agree.'
"'Well, no matter,' and the advocate frowned. "'There now, and it is said that we advocates get our money for nothing,' he remarked after a pause. "'I have freed one insolvent debtor from a totally false charge, and now they all flock to me. Yet every such case costs enormous labour. Why, don't we, too, lose bits of flesh in the inkstand, as some writer or other has said? Well, as to your case, or rather the case you are taking an interest in, it has been conducted abominably. There is no good reason for appealing. Still,' he continued, "'We can but try to get the sentence revoked. This is what I have noted down.'
He took up several sheets of paper covered with writing and began to read rapidly, slurring over the uninteresting legal terms and laying particular stress on some sentences.
"'To the Court of Appeal, Criminal Department, etc., etc., according to the decisions, etc., the verdict, etc., so-and-so Maslova pronounced guilty of having caused the death through poison of the merchant Smelkov, and has, according to Statute 1454 of the Penal Code, been sentenced to Siberia, etc., etc.'
He stopped. Evidently, in spite of his being so used to it, he still felt pleasure in listening to his own productions.
"'This sentence is the direct result of the most glaring judicial perversion and error,' he continued impressively. "'And there are grounds for its revocation. Firstly, the reading of the medical report of the examination of Smelkov's intestines was interrupted by the President at the very beginning. This is point one.'
"'But it was the prosecuting side that demanded this reading,' Nekhludov said, with surprise.
"'That does not matter. There might have been reasons for the defence to demand this reading, too.'
"'Oh, but there could have been no reason whatever for that.'
"'It is a ground for appeal, though. To continue. "'Secondly,' he went on reading, "'when Maslova's advocate, in his speech for the defence, "'wishing to characterise Maslova's personality, "'referred to the causes of her fall, "'he was interrupted by the President, "'calling him to order for the alleged deviation "'from the direct subject. "'Yet, as has been repeatedly pointed out by the Senate, "'the elucidation of the criminal's characteristics "'and his or her moral standpoint, in general, "'has a significance of the first importance in criminal cases, "'even if only as a guide in the settling of the question of imputation. That's point two, he said, with a look at Nekhludov.
But he spoke so badly that no one could make anything of it, Nekhludov said, still more astonished.
The fellow's quite a fool, and of course could not be expected to say anything sensible, Fanarin said, laughing. But all the same, it will do as a reason for appeal. Thirdly, "'The President, in his summing up, contrary to the direct decree of Section 1, Statute 801 of the Criminal Code, "'omitted to inform the jury what the judicial points are that constitute guilt, "'and did not mention that, having admitted the fact of Maslova having administered the poison to Smelkov, "'the jury had a right not to impute the guilt of murder to her, "'since the proofs of willful intent to deprive Smelkov of life were absent, "'and only to pronounce her guilty of carelessness resulting in the death of the merchant which she did not desire. This is the chief point.'
"'Yes, But we ought to have known that ourselves. It was our mistake.
And now the fourth point, the advocate continued. The form of the answer given by the jury contained an evident contradiction. Maslova is accused of wilfully poisoning Smelkov, her one object being that of cupidity, the only motive to commit murder she could have had. The jury, in their verdict, acquit her of the intent to rob or participation in the stealing of valuables, from which it follows that they intended also to acquit her of the intent to murder, and only, through a misunderstanding which arose from the incompleteness of the president's summing up, omitted to express it in due form in their answer. Therefore, an answer of this kind by the jury absolutely demanded the application of Statutes 816 and 808 of the Criminal Code of Procedure, i.e. an explanation by the President to the jury of the mistake made by them, and another debate on the question of the prisoner's guilt.
Then why did the President not do it?
I, too, should like to know why, Fanarin said, laughing.
Then the Senate will, of course, correct this error?
That will all depend on who will preside there at the time. Well, now there it is. I have further said, he continued rapidly, a verdict of this kind gave the court no right to condemn Maslova to be punished as a criminal and to apply Section 3, Statute 771 of the Penal Code to her case. This is a decided and gross violation of the basic principles of our criminal law. In view of the reasons stated, I have the honour of appealing to you, etc., etc., the refutation according to 909, 910, and Section 2, 912 and 928, Statute of the Criminal Code, etc., etc., to carry this case before another department of the same court for a further examination there. All that can be done is done. But, to be frank, I have little hope of success. Though, of course, it all depends on what members will be present at the Senate. If you have any influence there, you can but try.
I do know some.
All right. Only be quick about it. Else they'll all go off for a change of air. Then you may have to wait 3 months before they return. Then, in case of failure, we have still the possibility of appealing to His Majesty. This, too, depends on the private influence you can bring to work. In this case, too, I am at your service. I mean as to the working of the petition, not the influence.
Thank you. Now, as to your fees,
my assistant will hand you the petition and tell you.
One thing more. The procureur gave me a pass for visiting this person in prison, but they tell me I must also get a permission from the governor in order to get an interview at another time and in another place than those appointed. Is this necessary?
Yes, I think so. But the governor is away at present. A vice-governor is in his place, and he is such an impenetrable fool that you'll scarcely be able to do anything with him.
Is it Meslenikov?
Yes.
I know him, said Nekhludov, and got up to go. At this moment a horribly ugly, little, bony, snub-nosed, yellow-faced woman flew into the room. It was the advocate's wife, who did not seem to be in the least bit troubled by her ugliness. She was attired in the most original manner. She seemed enveloped in something made of velvet and silk, something yellow and green, and her thin hair was crimped. She stepped out triumphantly into the anteroom, followed by a tall, smiling man with a greenish complexion, dressed in a coat with silk facings and a white tie. This was an author. Nekhludov knew him by sight. She opened the cabinet door and said,
"Anatole, you must come to me. Here is Semyon Ivanovich, who will read his poems, and you must absolutely come and read about Garshin."
Nekhludov noticed that she whispered something to her husband, and, thinking it was something concerning him, wished to go away. But she caught him up and said,
"I beg your pardon, Prince, I know you, and, thinking an introduction superfluous, I beg you to stay and take part in our literary matinee. It will be most interesting. Monsieur Fanarin will read." "You see what a lot I have to do," said Fanarin, spreading out his hands and smilingly pointing to his wife, as if to show how impossible it was to resist so charming a creature.
Nekhludov thanked the advocate's wife with extreme politeness for the honour she did him in inviting him, but refused the invitation with a sad and solemn look and left the room.
"What an affected fellow," said the advocate's wife, when he had gone out.
In the anteroom, the assistant handed him a ready-written petition and said that the fees, including the business with the Senate and the Commission, would come to 1,000 rubles, and explained that Monsieur Fanarin did not usually undertake this kind of business, but did it only to oblige Nekhludov.
"And about this petition, who is to sign it?"
"The prisoner may do it herself, or if this is inconvenient, Monsieur Fanarin can, if he gets a power of attorney from her."
"Oh, no, I shall take the petition to her and get her to sign it," said Nekhludov, glad of the opportunity of seeing her before the appointed day. Chapter 46. A Prison Flogging. At the usual time, the jailer's whistle sounded in the corridors of the prison. The iron doors of the cells rattled. Bare feet pattered, heels clattered, and the prisoners, who acted as scavengers, passed along the corridors, filling the air with disgusting smells. The prisoners washed, dressed, and came out for revision, then went to get boiling water for their tea. The conversation at breakfast in all the cells was very lively. It was all about two prisoners who were to be flogged that day. One, Vasiliev, was a young man of some education, a clerk who had killed his mistress in a fit of jealousy. His fellow prisoners liked him because he was merry and generous and firm in his behaviour with the prison authorities. He knew the laws and insisted on their being carried out. Therefore he was disliked by the authorities. 3 weeks before, a jailer struck one of the scavengers who had spilt some soup over his new uniform. Vasiliev took the part of the scavenger, saying that it was not lawful to strike a prisoner.
"I'll teach you the law," said the jailer, and gave Vasiliev a scolding.
Vasiliev replied in like manner, and the jailer was going to hit him, but Vasiliev seized the jailer's hands, held them fast for about 3 minutes, and, after giving the hands a twist, pushed the jailer out of the door. The jailer complained to the inspector, who ordered Vasiliev to be put into a solitary cell. The solitary cells were a row of dark closets, locked from outside, and there were neither beds nor chairs nor tables in them, so that the inmates had to sit or lie on the dirty floor, while the rats, of which there were a great many in those cells, ran across them. The rats were so bold that they stole the bread from the prisoners, and even attacked them if they stopped moving. Vasiliev said he would not go into the solitary cell because he had not done anything wrong, but they used force. Then he began struggling, and two other prisoners helped him to free himself from the jailers. All the jailers assembled, and among them was Petrov, who was distinguished for his strength. The prisoners got thrown down and pushed into the solitary cells. The governor was immediately informed that something very like a rebellion had taken place, and he sent back an order to flog the two chief offenders, Vasiliev and the tramp, Nepomnishy, giving each 30 strokes with a birch rod. The flogging was appointed to take place in the women's interviewing room. All this was known in the prison since the evening, and it was being talked about with animation in all the cells. Korablyova, Khrushchevka, Theodosia, and Maslova sat together in their corner drinking tea, all of them flushed and animated by the vodka they had drunk, for Maslova, who now had a constant supply of vodka, freely treated her companions to it.
"He's not been a rioting or anything,"
Korablyova said, referring to Vasiliev, as she bit tiny pieces off a lump of sugar with her strong teeth.
"He only stuck up for a chum, because it's not lawful to strike prisoners nowadays."
"And he's a fine fellow, I've heard say," said Theodosia, who sat bareheaded, with her long plaits round her head, on a log of wood opposite the shelf bedstead on which the teapot stood. "There, now, if you were to ask him,"
the watchman's wife said to Maslova. By him she meant Nekhludov.
"I shall tell him. He'll do anything for me,"
Maslova said, tossing her head and smiling.
"Yes, but when is he coming? And they've already gone to fetch them," said Theodosia.
"It is terrible,"
she added with a sigh.
"I once did see how they flogged a peasant in the village. Father-in-law, he sent me once to the village elder. Well, I went, and there—"
The watchman's wife began her long story, which was interrupted by the sound of voices and steps in the corridor above them. The women were silent and sat listening.
"There they are, hauling him along, the devils," Khrushchevka said. "They'll do him to death, they will. The jailers are so enraged with him because he never would give in to them."
All was quiet again upstairs, and the watchman's wife finished her story of how she was that frightened when she went into the barn and saw them flogging a peasant, her inside turned at the sight, and so on. Khrushchevka related how Sheglov had been flogged and never uttered a sound. Then Theodosia put away the tea-things, and Korablyova and the watchman's wife took up their sewing. Maslova sat down on the bedstead, with her arms round her knees, dull and depressed. She was about to lie down and try to sleep when the woman warder called her into the office to see a visitor.
"Now mind and don't forget to tell him about us,"
the old woman, Mienshua, said, while Maslova was arranging the kerchief on her head before the dim looking-glass.
"We did not set fire to the house, but he himself, the fiend, did it. His workmen saw him do it and will not damn his soul by denying it. You just tell to ask to see my Mitri. Mitri will tell him all about it as plain as can be. Just think of our being locked up in prison when we never dreamt of any ill, while he, the fiend, is enjoying himself at the pub with another man's wife."
"That's not the law," remarked Korablyova.
"I'll tell him," answered Maslova. "Suppose I have another drop, just to keep up courage," she added with a wink, and Korablyova poured out half a cup of vodka, which Maslova drank. Then, having wiped her mouth and repeating the words, "just to keep up courage," tossing her head and smiling gaily, she followed the warder along the corridor. Chapter 47. Nekhludov again visits Maslova. Nekhludov had to wait in the hall for a long time. When he had arrived at the prison and rung at the entrance door, he handed the permission of the procureur to the jailer on duty, who met him.
"No, no," the jailer on duty said hurriedly. "The inspector is engaged."
"In the office?" asked Nekhludov.
"No, here in the interviewing room."
"Why, is it a visiting day today?"
"No, it's special business."
"I should like to see him. What am I to do?" said Nekhludov.
"When the inspector comes out, you'll tell him. Wait a bit," said the jailer.
At this moment a sergeant-major, with a smooth, shiny face and moustaches impregnated with tobacco smoke, came out of a side door, with the gold cords of his uniform glistening, and addressed the jailer in a severe tone.
"What do you mean by letting anyone in here? The office?"
"I was told the inspector was here," said Nekhludov, surprised at the agitation he noticed in the sergeant-major's manner. At this moment the inner door opened and Petrov came out, heated and perspiring.
"He'll remember it," he muttered, turning to the sergeant-major.
The latter pointed at Nekhludov by a look, and Petrov knitted his brows and went out through a door at the back. "Who will remember it? Why do they all seem so confused? Why did the sergeant-major make a sign to him?" Nekhludov thought. The sergeant-major, again addressing Nekhludov, said,
"You cannot meet here. Please step across to the office."
And Nekhludov was about to comply when the inspector came out of the door at the back, looking even more confused than his subordinates, and sighing continually. When he saw Nekhludov, he turned to the jailer.
"Fyodotov, have Maslova cell 5, women's ward, taken to the office. Will you come this way, please?" he said, turning to Nekhludov.
They ascended a steep staircase and entered a little room with one window, a writing table, and a few chairs in it. The inspector sat down.
"Mine are heavy, heavy duties," he remarked, again addressing Nekhludov, and took out a cigarette.
"You are tired, evidently," said Nekhludov.
"Tired of the whole of the service. The duties are very tiring. One tries to lighten their lot and only makes it worse. My only thought is how to get away. Heavy, heavy duties."
Nekhludov did not know what the inspector's particular difficulties were, but he saw that today he was in a peculiarly dejected and hopeless condition, calling for pity. "Yes, I should think the duties were heavy for a kind-hearted man," he said. "Why do you serve in this capacity?"
"I have a family."
"But if it is so hard?"
"Well, still, you know, it is possible to be of use in some measure. I soften down all I can. Another in my place would conduct the affairs quite differently. Why, we have more than 2,000 persons here, and what persons! One must know how to manage them. It is easier said than done, you know. After all, they are also men. One cannot help pitying them."